From WYPR, I'm Sheila Kast. We're on the record. The latest statewide numbers show a slight drop in fatal overdoses, but deaths are still being driven by opioids, not heroin, but fentanyl, a highly potent synthetic opioid often laced into heroin. WIPR reporter Mary Rose Madden looks at how Baltimore is grappling with the opioid epidemic in her series, In the Hole.
Slowly, they said that, you know, they started drinking Old English and smoking cigarettes, smoking marijuana, taking Valiums, and by the time they were teenagers, they said they didn't know that it was addictive, but they started shooting heroin. They had no idea, they said, what they were putting in their bodies.
And addiction medicine specialist Dr. Invild Olson describes how medication can help someone get off illicit drugs. It's On the Record after the news.
You're listening to On the Record, the podcast, a service of your public radio, 88.1 WYPR. Find more podcasts online at WYPR.org. And tell us what you think. Send an email to ontherecord@WYPR.org.
Good morning, I'm Sheila Kast. We're On the Record. There was a glimmer of hope, but also grim reality. In the preliminary data the Maryland Department of Health and Opioid Operational Command Center released last week on unintentional overdose deaths during the first 3 months of this year, there were 577 intoxication deaths across the state from January to March. That was a 14% reduction in deaths caused by opioids compared to the same period last year, although opioids are still the primary cause of intoxication deaths. Nearly 9 out of 10 deaths were caused by opioid overdoses. Most often it is fentanyl, not heroin or prescription opioids, that is killing people. Fentanyl is a synthetic opioid many times stronger than heroin. As the city grapples with the opioid overdose epidemic, WIPR reporter Mary Rose Madden is taking a close look at efforts to keep those who use drugs alive for one more day. Her series is called In the Hole. Mary Rose, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
What does In the Hole mean?
In the Hole is something I heard a lot hanging around with folks who are outreach workers or addicted to drugs themselves or who used to sell drugs. And it's a place where the stash of drugs is kept and drug dealers actually sell their drugs to others in the hole. And I thought it would be...
So it's a physical place of drug dealing.
It's a physical place of drug dealing. And I thought it would also be like a figurative place that we could go to in this reporting that would take us kind of closer to those who need help and to those who are trying to provide some outreach services to those people.
Right. You shadowed some outreach workers from Be More Power, a nonprofit connected to the city health department, who were offering materials for drug checking. Who are these outreach workers?
The outreach workers I met are folks who love working directly with people in need. So some of them were once addicted to drugs themselves. Others had family members who were addicted or are addicted. And other folks are just sort of kind of driven by the power of social work and want to be close to the streets, kind of building relationships with people.
What's in their kits?
For years, there have been needle exchanges, and those kits used to just have different ways of kind of helping people reduce the risk of either spreading infectious diseases or overdosing. So these days, there's Narcan, which is
the antidote.
The antidote to overdoses, right? There are condoms. There are fentanyl test strips now. And fentanyl test strips are now kind of going throughout the counties in Maryland to help folks check their drugs. So when they buy heroin or cocaine, they might not know that there's fentanyl in them. And this fentanyl test strip will show them.
How often are people encountering fentanyl in their drugs?
Well, the folks that I spoke to said that it's actually difficult to find heroin that isn't tainted with fentanyl. So they're finding...
It's the new normal.
It's the new normal, yeah.
What did outreach workers say about what people do with that information from drug checking?
I think fentanyl test strips were created with the idea that someone will be able to test their drugs, and if they're tested positive for fentanyl, hopefully, you know, they would choose not to use them because fentanyl is so deadly. But what we learned is that actually folks are using them to see if there's fentanyl in them, and that is kind of an enticing high for them because they know that this is like the strongest drugs they can find on the streets. So that information sort of isn't being used the way that health experts might have hoped. But interesting twist is that it is sort of having an effect on harm reduction, and that people are making changes to their use of the drug, and that maybe they'll shoot the drug a little slower, just sort of know that they need to be more cautious with this drug and maybe have Narcan more available when it's around.
And so they don't reject the drug, but they may pace themselves.
Right. Most people would say that they're not, you know, kind of throwing the drug away after they've bought it, but they're either pacing themselves or sharing it with someone else.
That's WIPR reporter Mary Rose Madden here on The Record on WIPR. I'm Sheila Cast. We're talking about her series In the Hole, which looks at how fentanyl is driving the opioid overdose crisis. You know, for years, people have called for treatment on demand. Is treatment available in Baltimore City?
So for folks who have Medicaid, there are a good number of opioid treatment programs in Baltimore City. In fact, in the past 7 years, I think the number of opioid treatment programs have doubled in Baltimore City for people with Medicaid. And the waiting lists have decreased drastically from months to weeks to now days. The person I was with, Mr. Alfred Jackson, he was able to get into an inpatient treatment facility immediately. So as soon as someone called, he could have checked in that day.
Let's hear a bit of one of your conversations with Alfred Jackson, longtime opioid user.
I don't even know how I lasted this long. I'm doing this every day. I'm not dedicated to the Suboxone like I should be. You understand what I'm saying? I'm supposed to take them Suboxone every day. But I wanted to be out here with the drugs.
Tell us about Alfred Jackson.
Well, Alfred Jackson is someone I met at Lexington Market. I met him with an outreach worker that I had just sort of built a connection with, Daryl Burrell. We met one morning while they were waiting for a friend of theirs who was in shock trauma because he had overdosed on opioids, and they were waiting to get word of their friend's condition. So we were, you know, just hanging out, talking about what Al's life had been like and, you know, kind of where he stood today with fentanyl on the streets. So he has a lifelong addiction. He's been addicted, as he says, since he was 14 or 15. He and Burrell grew up with about 15 guys down in South Baltimore, and they kind of described growing up in the 60s, just, you know, playing dice, shooting basketball. And then, you know, slowly they said that, you know, they started drinking Old English and, you know, smoking cigarettes, smoking marijuana, taking Valiums. And by the time they were teenagers, they said they didn't know that it was addictive, but they started shooting heroin. They had no idea, they said, what they were putting in their bodies. And I started meeting different members of this crew, and he's one of the last ones who is still out on the streets.
What's next in your series?
Oh, there's so much. So what's next is, so I wanted to look at the difference in quality of different treatment centers. So I wanted to look at a treatment center through Medicaid and a privately funded treatment center and kind of look at what patients encounter in different scenarios. There's actually a group that does like patient advocacy, and they start rating different treatment programs for people. And I thought that was really interesting.
Mary Rose, thank you for your reporting. Thanks.
No, thanks for having me.
WIPR reporter Mary Rose Madden's series on the opioid overdose epidemic is called In the Hole. At the On the Record page at WIPR.org, we have links to its episodes. Quick break here on the record. When we're back, we'll hear from the medical director of a treatment facility about the factors that predict whether someone will be able to maintain sobriety. I'm Sheila Cass. Stay tuned.
On the Record podcast, a service of Your Public Radio, member-supported 88.1 WYPR. You can support this podcast and everything you hear from WYPR. Become a member. Come to WYPR.org and click the donate link.
Welcome back to On the Record. I'm Sheila Cast. The number of deaths caused by fentanyl, a highly potent opioid many times stronger than morphine, has exploded in recent years and surpassed deaths caused by heroin. Fentanyl is a synthetic opioid. Just a few grains of the drug can be lethal. From 2016 to 2017, the number of fentanyl-related deaths increased by 42% in Maryland. Dr. Ingvild Olsen is medical director for the Institutes for Behavior Resources, Incorporated, which conducts behavioral science research and its outpatient substance use recovery program known as REACH Health Services. She also serves as vice president of the American Society for Addiction Medicine. She recently co-authored the book, The Opioid Epidemic, What Everyone Needs to Know. Welcome to On the Record.
Thank you so much.
Data from the National Center for Health Statistics at the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention shows that 30,000 Americans died of overdoses on synthetic opioids such as fentanyl in 2017. That's a rapid increase from fewer than 5,000 such deaths in 2013. What has this shift been like to witness?
So the onset of fentanyl and the appearance of fentanyl has really changed the landscape of substance use and how people are responding to what is on the street. It has been really devastating to not only see the numbers increase, but to actually have people come into treatment and now say, I've lost so many family members, friends, neighbors, coworkers. I have one patient who said that now he is the only survivor out of his classmate high school friend group of 11 people.
The others all died of overdoses.
Yeah. The other thing that we are seeing, though, is that there are people who are now coming into treatment in their 50s, 60s, even 70s, who have never been in treatment before because they are terrified. They're terrified of losing their lives. They are, they've witnessed all this destruction and devastation, and they want help. They don't want to be a statistic.
Preliminary data about overdose deaths in Maryland from January to March of this year indicates that opioid-related deaths are down 14%, with heroin-related deaths decreasing by 23%. Is it clear to you what's driven down the number of deaths caused by heroin?
So the reduction in heroin deaths is really primarily related to the increase in fentanyl. So fentanyl has essentially replaced heroin on the streets of Baltimore, as well as in many other cities and many other areas of the country. I have patients now who tell me it is very hard to find heroin on the street. All of it, what is out there, is fentanyl. Fentanyl is also being mixed in with other substances, such as cocaine. So we have now seen a rise in cocaine-related overdose deaths, but primarily that is because it's also mixed with fentanyl.
Is fentanyl by volume cheaper, so it bulks up? Or are sellers of drugs trying to entice users?
So there are a couple of reasons really why fentanyl has had the impact that it has. So first of all, it is completely synthetic. So it is made in a laboratory, which means that you don't have to wait for the poppy seeds to grow and cultivate them in order to get opium, which is then needed to make heroin. So the time frame for actually manufacturing fentanyl is much shorter compared to heroin. Second, because it is so potent, 50 to 100 times more potent than morphine and heroin, you don't need as much of it in order to be able to get an effect. And so from a dealer perspective, they don't need as much in order to actually have it out there on the streets and in the market. And so for both of those reasons, it is much cheaper. It is much less, you just don't need as much in order to, and what the dealers have goes just much further than what heroin allows for.
This is On the Record on WIPR. I'm Sheila Cass speaking with Dr. Ingvild Olsen, Medical Director of the Institutes for Behavior Resources, Incorporated, a comprehensive addiction research and treatment center in Baltimore City. We're talking about the role of fentanyl in the opioid overdose epidemic. We have spoken on this program about medication-assisted treatment, the use of prescription drugs to help people reduce or stop using illicit opioids. There's widespread stigma about these medications. How do these prescriptions work?
So we have three FDA-approved medications for the treatment of an opiate use disorder: methadone, buprenorphine, and naltrexone. And they all work slightly differently. They all work in the brain on the opioid receptor systems that we all are born with and that are part of what become hijacked and dysfunctional in people who have an opiate use disorder. So methadone and buprenorphine are both what are called opioid agonists. So when they bind to those areas of the brain that are involved in opiate use disorder, as well as in other places in the body, they really help to suppress withdrawal that people have from other opioids like heroin or fentanyl. They reduce the cravings that people have, and they really stabilize the brain and body function of people who have an opiate use disorder. Naltrexone works somewhat differently. It is a complete antagonist or a complete blocker, but it really doesn't do anything to suppress withdrawal. People do get some reduction in craving, and it does, in some people, help to stabilize the drive, the need that they might experience to use other opioids. But all three have tremendous amounts of research and data behind them in terms of their efficacy and safety in helping people manage their opiate use disorder.
What can be done to reduce the stigma of these prescriptions?
So the two medications that really have the most stigma are methadone and buprenorphine. They've been around the longest, and because they are opioids, people sometimes think that it is replacing one drug for another, when in fact that really is not the case. People who have an addiction to opioids have a compulsive need to keep using, and they keep using despite harmful consequences. Sometimes that harmful consequence includes the risk of death. And when people are taking methadone or buprenorphine, they are stable, they work, they take care of their families, they pay taxes, they pay their bills, they go to school. And in fact, no one could tell that they are actually taking one of these medications because they look just like everybody else. They are really stable, and just like somebody who needs to take a medication for another chronic condition like diabetes or high blood pressure, they're managing their disease, and really they are not addicted to that medication.
But for people who have used fentanyl, is medication-assisted treatment strong enough to be effective?
Absolutely. And in fact, what we know, particularly about methadone and buprenorphine, is that the use of those medications reduces someone's mortality risk or reduces someone's risk of death from fentanyl and other opioids by over 50%. So we can save lives and improve lives with the use of medications.
What are the long-term impacts of medication-assisted treatment?
So, you know, right now, there have been studies that have looked at some cognitive effects or other effects on people's bodies from long-term use of the medications that we have. And while all medications have side effects, so methadone and buprenorphine in particular have constipation as a side effect, they can reduce someone's sexual desire. But other than that, there does not really appear to be any significant impact on cognition, on function. The one thing we do need to keep in mind is that because methadone and buprenorphine, and less so with buprenorphine, is that both of them are opioid agonists, which means that in people who have never taken an opioid or have never used heroin or taken a Percocet, that methadone and buprenorphine can cause sedation and can reduce somebody's breathing to the point where overdose can happen. But for people who have an opioid use disorder, and in fact have the condition for which these medications are indicated, they are very safe and effective.
What are the factors that are the strongest predictors of success when someone enters treatment?
Yeah, so probably the one biggest factor that we know through good data and research is the longer someone stays in treatment, the more likely they are to achieve remission and recovery. You know, so we now think about treatment not as a 28-day episode where somebody goes to a residential facility and comes out and somehow is fixed. Mm-hmm. That doesn't happen with any chronic illness. We really now think about stages of or levels of care, meaning that people may need different intensities of services. So maybe when someone first starts treatment, perhaps they actually might need a residential stay to withdraw from alcohol or benzodiazepines or other substances they have been using, start a medication, one of the three FDA-approved medications for an opiate use disorder, or they start in an outpatient treatment setting, such as an intensive outpatient setting where they're also getting wraparound counseling services and other support services. But maybe that lasts for a period of time, and then they kind of step down or transition to a lower intensity level of care. So in Maryland, we use something called the ASAM criteria or the ASAM levels of care as the framework for our specialty addiction treatment system, meaning that we have different levels, so different intensities of counseling services and other ancillary services, support services, medical services need to be provided, needed psychiatric services. And all of that is very individualized based on a thorough assessment that really begins and should be the beginning of that treatment process to really identify what people's needs are. So not only in the medical and psychiatric realm and the addiction medicine realm, but also in terms of housing and financial support and transportation, and really the whole person is something that we need to look at and what all of their needs are broadly.
And in Baltimore, where you work, do you see those supports? Do you see those resources available?
So we are getting there. Baltimore certainly has had a long history of experience with opioids, from heroin and then now to fentanyl. I think there has been a growing recognition that we really need a spectrum, and we need this continuum of services all the way from harm reduction, where we provide people with access to syringes, for example, clean syringes, so that they're able to reduce their risk of getting HIV or spreading HIV and hepatitis C, all the way to the stabilization center that opened about a year ago, where people can actually access services and ongoing treatment if they are found in the field, having had an overdose, for example, to emergency departments. There are now hospitals. So the hospital level of care initiative that was started by the health department, all the way to specialty addiction treatment centers, outpatient centers like where I work, residential treatment centers, and then all the way then to recovery support. So we have mutual support groups like AA, NA, all the way to then really paying attention to people's housing and job opportunities. So we're getting there. We're not there yet. And this, because addiction is a chronic disease and we're kind of catching up, we really need the sustainable funding and sustainable resources that can meet our local needs. And that is where the CARE Act, which was introduced by Congressman Cummings and Senator Warren, that would really help to build that infrastructure, not just and address our needs, not just for now, but also for the future, because this is going to be with us. And if it's not fentanyl, it's going to be something else.
I'm grateful to you for walking us through this. Thank you so much. Thanks.
Great. Thank you so much for having me.
Dr. Ingvild Olsen is Medical Director for the Institute for Behavior Resources, Incorporated. She's also Vice President of the American Society for Addiction Medicine and co-author of The Opioid Epidemic, What Everyone Needs to Know. This is On the Record. I'm Sheila Cass. Glad you're listening. Join us again tomorrow.
Thanks for listening to this segment of On the Record with Sheila Cast. You can catch the show on the radio Monday through Friday, 9:30 to 10 a.m. on 88.1 WYPR, your NPR news station. And you can support On the Record and all the other public radio programs that WYPR brings to you. Just click the donate link at the top of WYPR.org. And thanks.